everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Historical Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for this channel. Today we'll be talking to Thomas Nock about his book, The Life and Times of George McGovern, Volume 1, The Rise of a Prairie Statesman. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here, Mark.
Oh, it's good to have you here. Tom, I wonder if you would begin by telling us a little about yourself.
Well, I'm a professor of history at Southern Methodist University in the Clements Department of History, and I teach courses in 20th century American politics and foreign policy. Earlier, I did a lot of work on the Progressive Era. I wrote a book about Woodrow Wilson called To End All Wars, Woodrow Wilson and the Quest for a New World Order. And, you know, lots of articles and journals and book chapters and anthologies, that sort of thing. And more recently, I've moved forward chronologically into the 20th century, into the era of the life of George McGovern, basically, which spans the Great Depression through close to the end of the Vietnam War. But his career, of course, ended with the advent of the Reagan presidency.
Okay. Could you tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book? It sounds like it's been a very consuming endeavor.
Yes. Well, it's biography. I always respected biographers, but I have a greater respect for them now, having done this myself, because one has to become an expert on all kinds of various topics and areas of the country, you know, the history of South Dakota in this case, and World War II B-24 bombers, and the Eisenhower administration, Kennedy, and so on, when you're dealing with somebody who had a career like George McGovern's. And also, when the McGovern papers came to Princeton in the late 70s and early 80s, and it was some while before they were able to get them organized so that scholars could use them. And in any case, I have been working on this for some period of time, but ultimately, after they got them all organized, the McGovern papers turned out to be a collection of about 850 linear feet. In any case, I had gotten interested in it in part because of my work on Woodrow Wilson. I'm very interested in liberal reform movements and war and the relationship between them, how quite often war has ended periods of domestic reform, the First World War, Second World War, and certainly the Vietnam War, killing off things like the Great Society, although there were other factors involved in that. But George McGovern is got a PhD in history after World War II, and he studied with my own mentor, Arthur Link, who at that time was at Northwestern University the first 8 or 10 years of his career. And then in the early 60s, Link moved to Princeton. But in any case, McGovern and Link remained friends all their lives. Link died in the late 1990s, and he arranged for McGovern to deposit his papers at Mudd Library at Princeton University. And that's what kind of intrigued me. And I also was one of those people who was in college. I was in college in the early to mid-70s, the latter portion of the Vietnam War era. And I became, you know, really quite interested and impressed with George McGovern because of his stand against the Vietnam War. And I was really interested in the fact that he was a historian of some note, and that sort of came out in the things he said and the things that concerned him. I started working on this in the latter part of the 90s. It also involved, I should say, a lot of oral history, not just manuscript research. I probably conducted well over 100 interviews with 20 or so very long ones with McGovern and family members and various senators and political colleagues of his, and all of that takes quite a while. And this volume covers his life from the beginnings up through 1968, which was a big, big turning point in, I think, American history and the history of American foreign policy, and certainly in the life of George McGovern.
One of the things I noticed in your notes is that among the people you interviewed, of course, was McGovern himself. But is this book in any way an official biography, or was it simply one that you worked, that you wrote in cooperation with him?
Well, I think probably the latter. No one has undertaken a major study of McGovern before mine. A historian at SUNY Albany did a very nice book on the 72 campaign, and some other people have taken an interest in other aspects of McGovern's career. I'm the first to undertake a big biography like this.
And I have to say, it does seem that you have this nice point at which to do it, which is that you're able to talk to so many of, you know, McGovern and so many of his contemporaries, and yet there's enough distance where you have access to so much more material.
That's right. But I didn't answer your question specifically. You asked if this is authorized. Not really formally. It's more a matter of him cooperating with me. And I think he probably saw me, in effect, as kind of a, I don't know exactly what an authorized biography is, because there are tons of biographies of all kinds of presidents and more recent political figures that come out periodically. But he was a very easy person to work with because he's generally very forthcoming, had a pretty good memory most of the time, very, very objective about himself, I think, his shortcomings, as well as the positive, mainly positive side to his career. He was really a great humanitarian, among other things, and addressed issues of tremendous concern to a lot of people about the general welfare of the body politic. He was very famous in his day in the 60s and 70s, a senator from South Dakota, a Democrat in a Republican state. And before he got into elected politics, he got the Democratic Party reorganized in the 1950s and was elected to the House for a couple of terms. And he worked in the Kennedy administration early in his career. He ran a program called Food for Peace, which you might want to talk about later on in detail. It's a humanitarian project that did a lot of good for millions of children in third world countries. And of course, when he was elected to the Senate in the early 60s, from the early to mid 60s onward and after, he became arguably the most insightful critic of the Vietnam War and won the Democratic presidential nomination in 1972. And he really inspired a lot of people, not only in that campaign, but in the years before that, in 68 and 1970 and so on. Bill Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton both cut their teeth in the 72 campaign. John Kerry was a big McGovern person. Tom Daschle, Eli Siegel, Gary Hart, lots of people like that. Bill Clinton was the principal speaker for the opening of the George and Eleanor McGovern Library at their alma mater, Dakota Wesleyan University, in October of 2006. And Clinton, in his remarks about McGovern, said, "In the storied history of American politics, I believe that no other presidential candidate ever had such an enduring impact in defeat." And that really is quite a tribute.
Maybe not exactly the one McGovern won. He probably wanted to be remembered.
Well, I mean, he's acknowledging the fact that McGovern, lost decisively in 72. But very, very, if you think about defeated, there's always a candidate who loses in a presidential election. And it's hard to come up with another candidate who lost who still had the kind of resonance and impact that George McGovern had. You don't think that way, with all due respect to them, to somebody like Walter Mondale or Michael Dukakis. That's, you see what I'm getting at.
I do.
Who inspired a generation, nonetheless, to pursue politics.
Well, I'd like to talk a bit more about his political career a little bit later on. Right now, I want to go back to his early years, his family.
Okay.
What was his family like? What was their background?
Well, he grew up in a religious household. His father was a Methodist minister. McGovern was one of four children. His father was kind of on the conservative side politically, and really the Great Depression, probably that and his upbringing in a religious household, those two things probably had the biggest impact on his his early life of the Depression, of course. You saw a lot of farmers struggling throughout his boyhood. He was drawn to politics early on. He was interested in his region's distinctive politicians, actually Republicans, progressive Republicans like George Norris and Robert La Follette. These were senators who had a real keen interest in the welfare of farmers and factory workers and small business people, that sort of thing. And in high school, he got involved in debate. He had an inspirational American history teacher who encouraged him to go out for debate. McGovern was kind of a shy child, particularly when he was in early grade school, and he came out of that gradually, but he really came out of it when he found his métier in debate. And debate, in a sense, was his introduction to politics, because as anyone who's ever done debate knows, you have to take different positions on different issues depending on whether you draw which side of the argument you draw, the affirmative or what have you. And the kinds of issues that he debated were reflective of his times, about war and the Depression, but things like whether the federal government should nationalize the country's railroads, or whether the U.S. and Great Britain should form a permanent alliance, that sort of thing. And he became regionally very, very well known as a, you know, really, really significant debater in the, you know, the kind of collegiate society of debaters and student government people, that kind of thing.
So, you know, starting in high school, he's orienting himself more to politics. He's looking forward. And then he goes to college.
Well, yes. He matriculated to Dakota Wesleyan University, and that's where he really came into his own as a famous debater. He wrote a regular column for the student newspaper, and he was involved in student politics, that sort of thing, and an excellent student. That's also where he met his wife-to-be, Eleanor McGovern. She and her sister, Isla, were both students there. And, of course, like a lot of people in the late 30s and early 1940s who were privileged enough to go to college, their education was interrupted by World War II, as was McGovern's.
I wonder if you could talk a bit about his attitude towards the war as it was approaching, because you write a bit about his engagement with the issues both in debate and in campus politics in 1940, 1941, in the run-up to the war.
Yeah, well, you know, that part of the country was sort of isolationist. And McGovern was a kind of an internationalist even then, I guess, because he certainly liked Franklin Roosevelt. His father and mother were nominally Republicans, but he never heard either of them criticize Roosevelt. And his father actually took him to Aberdeen, which is one of the larger cities in South Dakota, in, when was it, 1936, I guess. George would have been about 12 or 14, to see McGovern when he came through, to see Roosevelt when he did a swing through the state. But he certainly, after Pearl Harbor, engaged the issue of war. A lot of people, you know, were certainly reluctant to get into the war, and that's not necessarily because they were isolationists, although Roosevelt probably saw the handwriting on the wall better than most. But once Pearl Harbor was attacked, I think it was in February, that is to say, you know, a couple of months after Pearl Harbor, that McGovern and some of his pals drove down to Lincoln, Nebraska to sign up for the service. And he and some of his friends ended up going with the Army Air Corps because there was a lot of competition among the various branches of the service. And that particular day that they were there, the Army Air Force people were offering roast beef and mashed potato lunches. And so that's kind of how that started. And before the day was over, he and two or three of his friends signed a letter of understanding that they would join the Air Corps once they were called up. Early on in the war, it took a while to get sufficient trainers and planes just for training pilots. And so if you were going into that area of service, you weren't called up immediately the way infantry would. He got called, I guess, well over a year later. It was in the winter of 43, I think.
Was he able to finish his degree before he was called up, or did that have to take place
afterwards? He finished on the GI Bill after he came back from service as a bomber pilot. You know, that's quite a story, actually. Most people assume that McGovern was a pacifist because of his stand against the Vietnam War, but that's far from the case. He was not a pacifist. He just made a good case against the futility of the war in Vietnam. But he flew a B-24 bomber, a big, sluggish four-engine machine, on 35 missions over Germany and Austria, Poland, and these are really dangerous. You're really taking your life in your hands, literally, up in a plane over the Axis powers in Europe in World War II. And several of these were very, very harrowing missions. One particular mission, they lost two engines and they had to land on a little island in the Adriatic that didn't have a proper landing strip. On the very last mission, this was over Linz, Austria, they took 67 hits from flak that took out one of the engines, the nose cap, and all of the hydraulics of the plane. And this ended in a crash landing back at the base, but no one injured. So he went out on 35 potentially fatal missions and brought back his crew alive every time. And he, for that one, the Distinguished Flying Cross with three oak leaf clusters. If you take a look at the backgrounds of people who ran for president, say, in the 20th century, none of them really would have anything on George McGovern. He's right up there for a really impressive military record.
One of the things that impressed me when I was reading that section was not just, you know, McGovern's, you know, bravery in terms of flying during those 35 missions, but it was also his relationship with his flight crew and his and the leadership he showed to them. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit upon that.
Well, that's interesting. He had a very varied crew of nine men and from all walks of life, various stations and religions and cultures, that sort of thing. And McGovern had a very calming personality for them. Even when they were under intense anti-aircraft fire, he would keep them calm by having them check in with him as to their situation and their part of the plane and what they had to do, that sort of thing. He was self-conscious about his youth. You know, he was only 21 going on 22. But he was a year or two older than most of his crew. And so they, you know, this is a period of life. You think back about your own life when you're in your late teens and early 20s, a difference of 2 or 3 years seems like a lot. And, he grew a mustache for a while. He thought that would give him an older, more mature look about it, but he got rid of that after a while. But, it's an interesting demographic about people who served in World War II as opposed to Vietnam. The average age in World War II was 26, whereas it was just 19 for guys in Vietnam. But flyers often were a good bit younger, as was McGovern. But he had a great relationship with his crew. A lot of them, you know, obviously some of them would be Republicans as they went along in life, but they always had great things to say about McGovern's steadiness and courage under fire. There were a couple of incidences, about half a dozen out of the 35 flights that are like something out of a movie, and his crew, by and large, gave him credit for saving everybody's life because he was so good at what he did and steady at the helm.
And at the end of the war, he comes back to the United States. And as you mentioned, he finishes his degree at Dakota Wesleyan. What does he do with his life then?
Well, he finished up school, and he wasn't sure exactly what he wanted to do. His father, as I mentioned, was a Methodist minister, and he thought for a while that he might like to take that path, and he became a he went into Garrett Theological Seminary, which is near Evanston, Illinois, for a while, and he and Eleanor moved there, as did Eleanor's sister Eileen, her husband, who was a graduate student in history at Northwestern, just across the way, basically, from Garrett. And McGovern had a kind of fellowship that made him an apprentice minister, and he just gradually came to the conclusion that this path was not for him. And a couple of times he went with his brother-in-law, Bob Pennington, to a couple of lectures, particularly lectures by a man named Ray Allen Billington, whose field was American intellectual history and the history of the American frontier, and who was by all accounts a real stemwinder of a lecturer. And McGovern was really, really impressed, and his love of history really came back. And so he's kind of like a born again historian, and left Garrett to enter the program at Northwestern, where he came into contact not only with what Ray Allen and Billington, but also with Arthur Link, the great Woodrow Wilson scholar, a man named Richard Leopold, who became one of the early deans of American diplomatic history, and also a man named Lefton Stavrianos, who was a Europeanist, who had a big impact on McGovern as well. He was the author of a kind of Western Civ world history textbook, which went into, I think it was 11 editions. It stayed in print for 25 or 30 years. So it was a small department, but a very, very good one. And it it launched McGovern on his way into politics, because he emphasized political history and American foreign policy in a very heady time in American history after World War II and the early stages of the Cold War. That was quite an environment in which to study contemporary American history.
One of the points that really stood out as I was reading not just that part of the book, but also the later parts, is how it really does seem to have been an especially formative period for him intellectually, that a lot of what he was reading and discussing helped shape a lot of the views that he took into the 1950s and tested against you know, ongoing events once he becomes a teacher and then begins to look towards politics.
Well, that's right. In the area of politics, for instance, Arthur Link suggested that for his dissertation, McGovern write about the Colorado coal strike of 1913-1914. This is a really, really famous chapter in American labor history, and I think it remains the bloodiest, at least the second bloodiest, if not the bloodiest, labor upheaval in American labor history. And this was the story of John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s war, sort of, against coal miners in the southern coal fields of Colorado and their efforts to get better working conditions, shorter hours, better pay, and decent living conditions. And in any case, when he did his research for this, and since that time, incidentally, just in the last 10 years, a couple of major studies have come out. There's been a lot of work done on this, but McGovern was the pioneer in this particular field. And he had a sense of identification with the plight of the miners because of the farmers that he knew coming up during the Great Depression, who also struggled against social and economic forces beyond their control, just as these miners did. And through that and his various course readings, his conception of social politics and social conflict, his politics began to crystallize. That is to say that sometimes often conflict in American history brought about positive change. He saw that reflected in the coal strike, the Ludlow Massacre, and that whole saga. And he never stopped reading history after that. And that really came in handy. Also in this period, did a lot of reading, kind of the first draft of writing on the Cold War, particularly with regard to the coming of the Cold War in Asia. Theodore White, the famous political writer who did the series The Making of the President, 1960, for instance, and 64 and so on, wrote a great book in that period called Thunder Out of China. A man named Owen Lattimore, who got the trouble in the McCarthy period, had written a book called The Situation in Asia, and he spent a lot of time in Asia. And also John K. Fairbank, who's a very, very famous academic, wrote a great work on China that was very critical of American foreign policy after the war because it had unfortunately sided with a corrupt warlord by the name of Chiang Kai-shek. And most people who knew anything that was going on in China, in the State Department and elsewhere, knew that there was no way Chiang Kai-shek was the future of China, and that the communists led by Mao inevitably were going to triumph because they were so well disciplined and that they had close relationships with the peasantry because of what their cause was. And because also they killed a lot more Japanese invaders than Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists. And so he was reading stuff like that, and that drew him to Henry Wallace, who was occupied the leftward realm of the Democratic Party in the late 40s and had been arguably the greatest Secretary of State, Secretary of Agriculture in American history under FDR in the 30s and became his vice president during the war, but got dumped in 44. Because Democrats were worried that FDR might not survive a fourth term, and they were concerned about Henry Wallace's location on the political spectrum and the kinds of things that really animated him. And so Roosevelt let him go and replaced him with Harry Truman. And Wallace became kind of an early, insightful critic of Cold War policy, and that attracted a lot of younger people like McGovern, and McGovern became... he actually attended the Progressive Party convention in 48. But gradually he found himself, you know, Wallace did not do very well in that election. It was a dead heat, it seemed, between Truman and Dewey, although Truman ended up winning by 3 or 4% of the popular vote. And McGovern gradually found himself, you know, gravitating back toward the Democratic Party. At least Stevenson in particular, he really, really admired. In the meanwhile, he, you know, had finished his dissertation and was offered a job at Dakota Wesleyan. He taught there for about 2 or 3 years before actually getting into political activity in South Dakota.
Now, during that time, he, you know, was a very, you know, politically very challenging time. It was the Red Scare. There was a lot of concern about politics. And yet McGovern made no secret of his views and his beliefs, even if they might engender controversy.
That's right. It's really quite interesting. He never ran for office when he wasn't attacked, red-baited, particularly early on. But he had a couple of things going for him. One was his war record. I mean, no one could, although occasionally Republicans tried to imply that he was lacking in patriotism, anybody who flies 35 missions against the Nazis like he did, you know, has earned their red, white, and blue stripes, I think. And I think most South Dakotans, certainly in the eastern part of South Dakota where he lived in the area he represented, came to have a lot of respect for him, whether or not they agree with his positions politically. But also, this has something to do with his personality. If you perhaps read certain positions he might take on a particular issue, it might seem a little bit out of the ordinary for a middle-of-the-road politician. If you heard him talk about it, though, one-on-one or in a speech, he had a way, a knack of speaking that made what he was saying sound like so reasonable and just the logical conclusion that any thoughtful person would come to. That was really kind of a gift, and he was particularly adept at explaining complex issues that everyday people, without talking down to people, that everyday people could understand. Also, once he was elected in 56, and he had a rough go with that, but he was running against a three-term incumbent, and he still prevailed over him. That guy, Lovery was his name, attempted to make an issue of McGovern's advocacy of the membership of the People's Republic of China in the UN, and tried to cast aspersions on his patriotism. And it turned out that this guy had not served in the service when he possibly could have. But in any case, a lot of Republicans, who veterans who respected McGovern, came to his aid in this, and he won handily. And then he became a very, very astute student of agriculture, and represented the state's interests quite effectively. And of course, agriculture was number one enterprise in South Dakota. And because he was so good at that, and he was young and articulate, and he impressed people, when he took critical stances, say, against Eisenhower's foreign policy in his first term in Congress, that didn't matter so much to them, to his constituents, because he did such a good job otherwise. And they paid attention to what he said there, and a lot of people, you know, came to support him. Nonetheless, farmers remained. You know, in the years ahead, McGovern became one of the leading experts on agriculture in the United States. And farmers in South Dakota became a mainstay in his political success. In even, say, in 1968, when the Vietnam War was at a kind of crescendo, about 66% of the farmers of South Dakota supported McGovern.
That's a quite impressive number.
That is, and those things explain how it was he was successful in a state like South Dakota. The other thing also, when you're talking about 1968, where this book comes to a kind of climax, I think probably by that point a majority of South Dakotans had come to agree with McGovern on Vietnam, and partly so because up to that point, the Vietnam War had been presided over by a Democratic administration. And they thought McGovern was pretty brave to take on his own president, so to speak, that is to say, Lyndon Johnson. And so that explains part of it for that period. Of course, in the latter stages, in 71 and 72 with Richard Nixon, who was a Republican, and we're still in the war, and McGovern is still, of course, roundly opposed to that war, then that partisan element, that quality of the whole political issue of Vietnam becomes, it's not quite the asset for McGovern that it gradually became in his earlier period in the Senate, that first full term when he was elected in 62 to the time of his reelection in 1968.
One of the points that you made that I thought was interesting was you talk about his interpersonal skills in terms of interacting with voters. And I was thinking that I think that the size of the South Dakota electorate, was a factor there. Because as you mentioned, I think it was with the 1960 race, the 1962 mm-hmm. race, that it was possible for him to have shaken hands with every voter in South Dakota.
Yes, he certainly, I'm sure, I have no doubt that he had by 1968, because, you know, he ran for election. I think that was his fifth time running for election. He ran in 56 and in 58 successfully for the House. And then in 1960, he ran for the Senate against a very powerful conservative Republican incumbent, Carl Mundt, and lost. And then in 62, he ran and won, and of course won again in 1968. But, you know, the 1960 race is very interesting. It was the biggest turnout in the history of South Dakota, as it was in a lot of states in 1960, because both major parties were putting out fresh horses, John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon. And South Dakota was one of those senatorial races that got national attention because Mundt was a famous incumbent, and here was this young whippersnapper, George McGovern, challenging him. It's interesting that I think it was about a little over 300,000 votes cast in South Dakota in 1960. And Nixon won South Dakota by 50,000 votes. They really liked Nixon. And, you know, he roundly defeated JFK. However, McGovern came within 15,000 votes of capsizing month. So a lot of people who voted for Nixon for president split their ticket and voted for McGovern, although not quite enough. So that's an interesting element of the impact of his personality as well as his skills politically. And of course,
Another commonality, though, that I noticed in the book, which was that the degree to which both in his career in the House and then the time that you described the Senate is the degree to which he was in a point of opposition against the presidency in a way that really that his constituents agreed with. And here I'm thinking primarily about the person who seems to be the great villain in South Dakota in the 1950s, which was Ezra Taft Benson.
Yes. Yeah, well, that was because Benson was a very conservative Secretary of Agriculture who was very much against subsidies to agriculture to bring prices, what the income of farmers would be, to bring it in line with the income of city folks, parity. And what Benson came up with was something called the soil bank, where you'd set aside land. You wouldn't put crops in a particular acreage, which really favored larger agricultural enterprises, including corporate agriculture. And McGovern, in his very first term, first few months in office, submitted an amendment to a very controversial farm bill that would have provided 90% parity payments, that is to say, a subsidy from the federal government to bring farmers' income up to 90% of parity. And parity was you choose a particularly good year that was a reasonable, decent income for farmers, and you try to get within 90% of that with a combination of what the market force brought you for the commodity and then a subsidy. And it varied from wheat to corn to rye to cotton and what have you. It's really kind of complicated. But in any case, he proposed this amendment that failed, but it failed by only 4 votes. And he got a lot of attention in the agricultural press, and the people in South Dakota were very impressed that their first-term congressman did this. But in a sense, in 1956 and 58 and 1960, McGovern ran against Ezra Taft Benson because he came to be so hated among farmers. He was the one area that of Eisenhower's policy that most farmers who otherwise liked Eisenhower, they really resented, majority of them did, Ezra Taft Benson's policies. And the fact that Eisenhower had reneged on a promise that he made during the 52 campaign, actually in South Dakota, that he would support this 90% parity program that the Democratic Party had always supported from the days of the New Deal, and Harry Truman certainly did too.
And so he has this prominent position. He has this very close race against Carl Mundt, and then he's a man without a job.
Well, kind of without a job. His defeat in 1960 actually contained a great opportunity. He had impressed John F. Kennedy. Kennedy and Nixon, because the race was so contested in 1960, Nixon and Kennedy both went to South Dakota a couple of times. It was only 4 electoral votes. It wasn't California or Illinois or New York, but every electoral vote counted. And Kennedy was very impressed with Nixon. So was Bobby, who traveled with Jack a lot. And when they left one trip in October, because McGovern was so loyal to the ticket, they feared, Kennedy made the remark to Bobby, he said, I worry that we cost that good man a Senate seat, Bobby. And he knew McGovern from, they worked together on labor legislation and agricultural legislation in the late 50s, and Kennedy learned a lot from McGovern about agriculture, and he coached him on the kinds of things that he should stress in the speeches that he made in South Dakota. Make a long story short, Kennedy wanted to bring and did bring McGovern into his administration as a special assistant to the president and director of Food for Peace. And Food for Peace was a really, really great opportunity for McGovern to show what he could do. This was a program that actually came about in the early 50s under Eisenhower to alleviate the burden of America's huge grain surpluses by distributing them abroad. The Eisenhower administration was kind of clumsy and ham-handed about this, and critics called it a dumping program. When McGovern took the program over, he was a lot more sensitive to the particular needs of recipient countries, and he engineered a vast expansion of the program and turned it into a kind of a dynamic tool of foreign policy. For 2 years, he traveled constantly overseeing allotments of millions of tons of surplus American food and fiber that would be used, for example, as what he called self-help capital to fuel labor-intensive economic development projects. And in 20 underdevelopment countries, Food for Peace provided partial wage payments for workers engaged in kind of the equivalent of WPA projects, land clearance and irrigation projects and construction of dams and roads and schools and that sort of thing. In a lot of third world countries, as much as half, if not more, of one's income might go toward procuring food. And this Food for Wages program provided that kind of sustenance for upwards of 700,000 workers, not just the workers, but also their families. And for McGovern, this was the way to fight the Cold War, by launching these kinds of projects while also improving the nutritional health of the workers and their families. But the thing that was really dearest to his heart was the overseas school lunch program, which he worked tirelessly to revitalize in countries like South Korea and South Vietnam, Mexico, Brazil, the Philippines, India especially, and I guess about at least a dozen other countries. And among other things, his dedication to this school lunch program resulted in dramatic improvements in school attendance, often like, 30% and 40%, and in the health of literally tens of millions of malnourished children in every part of the globe. And this also engendered a lot of goodwill for the U.S. And so I argue that McGovern had superintended arguably the single greatest humanitarian achievement of the Kennedy-Johnson era. And of course, the experience had a lasting impact on his thinking about the ways that big, powerful countries like the U.S. might figure in the life of smaller, weaker countries. That this Food for Peace was a constructive instrument of foreign policy. And he'd relate to his constituency this way. He'd talk about the interrelatedness between education, agriculture, and foreign policy in the Cold War. And this was the right way to reckon with and prevail over the Soviets.
It really does seem to have been a position that was tailor-made for him, and it also really is intriguing in the sense of it's the one time in his career where he's really able to take a lot of his ideas and put them into action as an executive.
That's right.
As opposed to simply advocating them and shaping laws as a legislator.
Yeah, and he also used it in an interesting way politically. One of the things he liked to tell audiences, he did a lot of PR work for it all over the country, and he got great press for it. But he'd say something like this. He would point out that here in the United States, I think it was about 8% of the population of the U.S. Worked in agriculture. And our 8% was five times more productive than their counterparts in Russia, who made up nearly half of the Soviet Union's labor force. In other words, our 8%, five times more productive than half the Soviet population. And that's really, really pretty impressive. And that's how he'd make that case for Food for Peace as being a better way to fight the Cold War. And then he'd end it by, he'd quote Walt Rostow, who once made the remark, "Marx was a city boy." To explain this, that's really an interesting failure of the Soviet Union. And if you want to look at, all kinds of factors in the collapse of the Soviet Union, that is definitely one of them. The Soviets never could produce good consumer goods, and they had a hard time feeding themselves, their own people. And food was as important as any other factor that way for us in the Cold War, and it was probably second only to our war arsenal in World War II. And Henry Wallace was responsible for amassing the kinds of foodstuffs that were essential to victory in World War II. And McGovern knew those things, and he knew how to put them across effectively.
And yet, for all the good that he was doing this position, he still thinks about the Senate. How did he get involved in the Senate race in 1962?
Well, he always it was more important to him. He just wanted to be a senator, and he talked to Kennedy about it, and Kennedy gave him his blessings, and he ran against a guy named Joe Bottom, and won. It was very close. Again, in the neighborhood of 300,000 votes, and he won by, there was a recount, and he won by 597 votes. And so he was in the Senate, but he didn't take long to make his presence known. He introduced some really interesting legislation. In this period, when he entered the Senate, it's between the happy conclusion to the missile crisis and a year or so before the big buildup in Vietnam. And he introduced, he thought that there was a possibility of curbing the nuclear arms race and trimming down the size of our military-industrial complex. And one of the things he proposed was a $5 billion cut in defense appropriations, which were about $54 billion. That was half of the federal budget. And he pointed out that the two superpowers together had amassed somewhere between 40 to 60 billion tons of TNT in their stockpiles, which was enough to kill virtually everything on the face of the earth many, many times over. And so what possible advantage would accrue from spending more billions of dollars on this kind of overkill capacity? And he argued it was time to consider national security needs alongside their implications for American society. And he outlined all the things you could do with that $5 billion savings. And you could build a school in every one of the country's 3,000 counties and 500 hospitals and establish 100,000 federal scholarships worth $5,000 each and still have enough left over to reduce the budget by $1 billion. So those were the kinds of things that he was interested in.
Did his position alienate John Kennedy, or did it jeopardize his friendship with him?
No. His first speech, his maiden speech, was about, it's called our Castro fixation versus the Alliance for Progress, which was Kennedy's Marshall Plan for Latin America, rather delayed. Latin America would have liked some sort of Marshall Plan in the immediate post-war World War II period, and was never forthcoming. But in any case, he was not necessarily critical of the Kennedy administration in Korea, but he thought that the problem, Latin America's problems were not caused by Fidel Castro or Khrushchev. The problems were the system throughout Latin America that we supported, which was military governments and oligarchies and extreme poverty on the part of, most of the populace. And here, this gets him around to advocating strongly things like more food for peace programs, as well as the Alliance for Progress, where he was actually fairly openly critical of Kennedy was in Vietnam. One speech, he was talking about this $55 billion budget for defense, was the first time he ever talked about Vietnam. He referred to the current dilemma in Vietnam as a clear demonstration of the limitations of military power. And he talked about this ragged band of illiterate guerrillas fighting with homemade weapons against this tyrannical government in Saigon that existed only because the U.S. created it and financed it. And he said President Kennedy's policy, alas, is scarcely one of victory or even stalemate. Rather, it's a policy of moral debacle and political defeat. And he ended this, which was really one of the very earliest trenchant commentaries on Vietnam by anyone in Congress. He ended it with with a prophetic warning. He said, the failure in Vietnam will not remain confined to Vietnam. The trap we have fallen into there will haunt us in every corner of this revolutionary globe if we do not properly appraise its lessons and rely less on armaments and more on the economic, political, and moral sources of our strength. That's pretty powerful. That's Vietnam while, you know, John F. Kennedy, that's September of 1963.
And within a couple of months, it's no longer a criticism of Kennedy's Vietnam policy, it's a criticism of Lyndon Johnson's Vietnam policy.
That's right. That's right.
I was wondering if you could speak a bit to his relationship with Lyndon Johnson, because that is, you know, a topic that, you know, runs through the remainder of the volume. Did he have the same relationship with LBJ?
No, probably of all the presidents he worked with or served under, he had the closest relationship with JFK. And JFK and Bobby also took this is no gloss on my part, they took a real interest in him personally, and they did things to help him. They just took a liking to him, and they respected him tremendously. And that's when both JFK and RFK were killed, particularly RFK just 5 years later. That really just that took everybody down, and McGovern grieved deeply over those losses. But they really, really worked closely with him, and he liked them a great deal. The case of Johnson, they kind of liked each other from the very early times, and I must say that of all the presidents since FDR, McGovern knew this certainly, that LBJ was really the authentic heir to the tradition of FDR and the New Deal. And there were no stronger, stauncher supporters of Lyndon Johnson when it came to things like the Great Society, his Medicare program, federal aid to education and civil rights legislation. No stronger advocate of Johnson's work than George McGovern. But, of course, Vietnam ended up changing that. You know, in 64, when Johnson's running against Goldwater, you had the famous Gulf of Tonkin incident that probably never occurred, but Johnson seized on it, in part because Goldwater was a real hawk on Vietnam and was attacking him for not taking due notice of Vietnam, which was hardly the case. But in any event, Johnson seized upon this alleged incident of PT boats attacking a couple of American destroyers in August of 64 to get from Congress the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which was an open-ended authorization for military action against North Vietnam. And that went through the House unanimously, and only two people in the Senate voted against it. McGovern voted for it with misgivings, and he lived to regret the vote because, of course, just a couple of months after Johnson was inaugurated, after a huge landslide victory, he was no longer the peace candidate that he had portrayed himself as in order to defeat Goldwater. And McGovern, as early as March 1965, was invited on CBS News for a special program on Vietnam. He was talking about denouncing the idea of escalation and massive bombing is worse than futile, and predicting a staggering loss of life out of all proportion to the stakes involved. And he said it'd be a lot better for politicians to take some political risks for a negotiated settlement than for us to risk a course that might cost the lives of thousands of or hundreds of thousands, possibly, of our own citizens. He wasn't unsympathetic. He had a couple meetings with Johnson, one when he endeavored to refute this notion that Johnson had Ho Chi Minh, the leader of North Vietnam, was a surrogate for Red China, and McGovern tried to explain the fact that Vietnam and China had been enemies for 1,000 years, and that Ho really, first and foremost, was a nationalist who might serve as a barrier against communist Chinese expansion, and Johnson didn't have any use for that. He said he didn't have time to be sitting around this desk reading history books, and so that didn't go too far. Some of the things McGovern said about, I mean, he made such a persuasive case publicly on the floor of the Senate, along with maybe 7 or 8 in the early years, 65 and 66, about this. He explained things. I'll read you a portion of some of his comments. He's was talking about the bombing, Rolling Thunder, that began in March of 65. He said that the guerrillas in the South, you know, they're part of the people and terrain, and in many cases they're farmers by day and fighters by night. And to bomb them was to bomb the children and the women and the villagers and peasants with whom they intermingled. To destroy their crops is to destroy the countryside on which the general population depended. And so to escalate the war would only strengthen the guerrillas' cause in the eyes of South Vietnamese and destroy the moral influence of the U.S. And he talked about the waste and resources. He said, does it make sense to use a $2 million plane carrying a $10,000 bomb load to knock out a grass hut or a rope bridge that'll be repaired by nightfall? And then, you know, on the ground from the middle of 65 onward, we were increasing our troop levels by 100,000 a year through 1967 into 68, while more than twice that number of Vietnamese came of draft age annually, and that was a perfect formula for stalemate. And, of course, between March 65 and the end of just 67, before you even get to 1968, B-52s dropped on Vietnam 1.5 million tons of bombs, 500,000 on the north, 1 million on the south, exceeding the combined tonnage of bombs dropped by all the belligerents in World War II. And by the time you get there, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, by that point, you know, most of North Vietnam's infrastructure was in ruins. Napalm, Agent Orange had destroyed about half of all South Vietnam's forests. By the end of 67, 16,000 American soldiers had been killed and over 60,000 wounded, and another 14,000 GIs would be killed in 68. That was the single worst year for us. And Vietnamese deaths numbered in the hundreds of thousands. And we were spending, to accomplish all that, spending about $2 billion a month, which was a sum exceeding the War on Poverty's budget for all of 1966. And still the enemy's will to carry on the struggle seemed undiminished. And here at home, the U.S. was in turmoil on a scale you have to go back to the Civil War to find something like it. And by that point, McGovern Milley had emerged as the leading critic of the war within the liberal establishment, anyhow, that had conceived the war.
His criticisms of the air war strike me as especially poignant, given that his own experiences in World War II as a bomber pilot. And I was thinking about that section in the chapter on the war where he accidentally bombed a farmhouse, how that stayed with him. And I can see how a lot of his critiques and analysis of the bombing campaign in Vietnam draw back upon that very personal experience of having been in that situation, of being the bomber, having thought about what it means to be doing something like that.
That's a very insightful observation, really, Mark. No, that's true. You know, bomber pilots, all bomber pilots, whether it's Vietnam or World War II, they're at a great remove. They can't see the destruction that they're causing, or the people who are getting, you know, killed by their bombs. And they had a situation returning on a flight after, you know, bombing marshalling yards or something like that, where they had a bomb stuck in the racks. And that's a very dangerous situation in World War II bombers, because they were really dangerous crafts. And what they wanted to do was drop it, you know, into the ocean, which you often did if you didn't get to drop all your bombs. You just did not want to land with those kinds of bombs. And they're struggling with it, and they're still over land, and it was let loose, and they could see that it went down and just blew the heck out of a farmhouse. And McGovern thought about, you know, his friends back in South Dakota. The other thing was that he took, in his career, several trips to Vietnam. He'd actually, you know, worked on getting food for peace resources to Vietnam to help refugees from flooding in South Vietnam. But in November of 65, he spent a few days in Vietnam, and he visited hospitals where RGIs were, and also hospitals where wounded South Vietnamese civilians were. And this really, really sickened him. And he had an audience with Westmoreland for an hour or so. He liked Westmoreland very much personally, had a lot of respect for him, but Westmoreland was, you know, perpetrating a kind of a conventional warfare he was conducting in a very unconventional situation. And so he was always mindful of that because he knew what this was doing.
So by 1968, McGovern is this very visible critic of the war within the Democratic Party, within the president's own party. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about his role in the 1968 presidential primaries and
sure.
how he went from how he emerged in the convention itself as a possible nominee.
Yeah, well, 1968 some people say it's one of the worst years in U.S. history. It opened in late January of 68 with the famous Tet Offensive. This came on the heels of Johnson bringing Westmoreland home late in 67 to talk about the progress in the war and that there was light at the end of the tunnel, that sort of thing. And Tet was a multi-pronged offensive throughout Vietnam in almost all of the provincial capitals. The National Liberation Front guerrillas, along with regular troops from North Vietnam. And the mere fact that they could undertake this was a blow to the cause in general. And it helped to undermine Johnson's political situation in early 68. But before that, you had Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota and then Bobby Kennedy challenging Johnson's authority. McCarthy entered the New Hampshire primary in late February of 68. He lost, but he got 42% of the vote, and that was tantamount to a defeat to an incumbent president. Then Bobby Kennedy got into the mix, and the combination of the impact of Tet, what Tet did politically was to cause, for the first time, a majority of Americans to see the war as a mistake and wanting to get out one way or the other. And the combination of the impact of Tet and McCarthy and Kennedy's entry into the primaries brought about Johnson's decision to announce that he was not going to be a candidate for re-election in 68. Then just 4 days after that, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And then in early June, Bobby Kennedy, on the night he won the California primary over McCarthy, he was assassinated. And he and McGovern were very, very close at this point. McGovern made a very famous speech in April of 67 called The Lessons of Vietnam, which Kennedy, when he was running in the primaries in 68, said was the most powerful and most influential of all the speeches he ever heard on Vietnam. Well, when Kennedy was killed, Kennedy's people were bereft, and there was a kind of movement to sort of draft McGovern into the primary race, and he decided to do this in part to help to secure in the party's platform a plank calling for a bombing halt in Vietnam and the start of serious negotiations to end the war. And that's something, of course, that the McCarthy people wanted too. But what happened at the convention was Hubert Humphrey, who was vice president, was basically, you know, the administration's man and had, even though I don't think his heart was fully in it, he was one of the administration's point men pressing to stay the course in Vietnam. And during the Democratic convention on the second day, there was a nationally televised debate about Vietnam, basically, between McGovern, Eugene McCarthy and Hubert Humphrey. And McCarthy was in a crabby mood and came across that way. And Humphrey found himself defending Johnson. And McGovern basically creamed both of them in making a case against pursuing the war this way and trying to get out. along the lines of the things I was talking about earlier. And of all the Democrats, only McGovern emerged from Chicago with an enhanced reputation. Humphrey won the nomination, but and this is one of the connections with our politics today, and I think the whole story of Vietnam is, with regard, in many ways anyhow, with regard to the issue of the Middle East these days. But Humphrey had not won a single primary, but he copped the nomination because two-thirds of the delegates were chosen by tightly controlled state organizations, and often in secret. And afterward, many Democrats felt that Humphrey's nomination and the demise of the peace plank, which Humphrey actually supported, but which Lyndon Johnson from his ranch in Texas crushed, the combination of those two factors caused a lot of Democrats to think that there was a process underway that flaunted the very name of their party, and they wanted change. And that's where you get the beginnings of a greater number of primaries and the advent of caucuses, actually under the aegis of George McGovern's commission that the Democrats put together in the wake of the disaster of 1968. To make a long story short, as I say, of all the Democrats, McGovern emerged from Chicago with an enhanced reputation, and he was declared kind of an overnight star by major publications. Time magazine said he was one of the three most likely prospects for the party's nomination in 72, and also by that point probably a majority of, as I said before, South Dakotans had come to agree with him on the war. And it was a tough reelection bid for him in 68, but 90% of the Democrats of South Dakota and 40% of the state's Republicans voted for McGovern, and he won by 58% of the vote. It was really a big victory for him.
So he finishes the year with this very enhanced stature, both, you know, in his own home state, having won a very dramatic victory, and also he is now he's one of the leading, if not the leading, anti-war Democrat facing it with Republicans about to take.
Well, and also he's not one of just 10 or 12. He's probably a good 40%. If you look at the vote on this compromise plank that went down 40% to 60%. And so the Democratic Party was a 60-40 party at that time. And that's why you had, the reforms to increase the number of primaries. So that, today, you know, you hear a lot of complaints about the situation today, or we used to anyhow, but it's really more democratic than it had ever been. And that democratic element were actually, you know, voters themselves through more primaries, basically choose who party nominees are. That was not the case until you get up to 1972 and 76 and so on, and the Republicans were maybe one electoral cycle behind the Democrats in adopting that approach. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, it sounds like a story for Volume 2, which leads me naturally to the question, how's it coming along?
Yeah, but I think the one thing that one gets out of this portion of the study is George McGovern's legacy with regard to foreign policy. In his second term, he presided over these reforms in the process of selecting delegates, and he made Americans aware of the fact that there was hunger in their midst, and he was able to push through the most significant expansion of food stamps, for instance, ever undertaken, quadrupling its scope. But I think his most important legacy for his whole career had already been established, and that was his great priority to get the country out of Vietnam and help Americans figure out how they got there. Just the December before he began his second term, he gave the plenary address at the American Historical Association convention in New York, and he said, in part, as a practicing politician increasingly grateful for his own historical education, this is him speaking, he believed that the quest for a more peaceful international community is the most crucial task of our age. And he said it was his conviction that the only potential gain that could come of Vietnam was the humility and wisdom that may guide us toward a more rational view of our future role in the international community. Vietnam should have taught us a new respect for caution and restraint in the exercise of military power abroad. And the real issue, he said, is whether the United States shall continue to intervene unilaterally in the affairs of other states, as we have done during the 1960s, or will we seek to move away from this go-it-alone approach toward a greater measure of international cooperation based on a respect for the world's diversity? Now, he couldn't have guessed it, but I think he put his finger on the core problem of American foreign policy that would endure into the 21st century. And I think that's the real relevance and legacy of George McGovern, and it's a legacy to this current campaign as well.
In your second volume, will be you be returning to that
the subject of Vietnam? Well, yes.
Not just the Vietnam. I was thinking more of that overall analysis of foreign policy, not just when he was a senator, but in his years after the Senate, because McGovern, only passed away just a few years ago. He was witness to not just the end of Vietnam, but Grenada, the Gulf War, Somalia, right up to Afghanistan and Iraq.
That's right. That's right. But that's probably why I say that's where his greatest legacy lies, because of the warnings about what a terrible mistake Vietnam was, that we're fighting there for no good reason and actually making things worse than they were, and squandering incalculable resources that could have been used to address essential needs at home. And so you're right. There we have an analogy, not just with Richard Nixon's Vietnam and after that, but after McGovern's sort of out of politics, although he always, he made the rounds on TV talk shows and that sort of thing. But, he very much opposed the second Gulf War that began in 2003. Actually, just as Bernie Sanders and Barack Obama did, was always concerned about our allocation of resources, of spending all these resources on something like that war in the Gulf, when we need to do stuff at home in our cities and expand opportunities for higher education and maybe think about building a national light rail transportation system and try in the hope of trying to reverse global warming and things like that. All of those are part of the overall legacy, and there are just a lot of reasons why I think all Democrats today should appreciate and respect George McGovern.
Well, Tom, we've taken a lot of your time, but before we go, I want to go back to that one unanswered question. How is Volume 2 coming along?
Well, I'm hoping to have it out in the next electoral cycle. I have finished virtually all the research. I had done most of it all at once over a period of time, but I found myself realizing that I had done lots of reviews and research for a two-volume work, basically. And what it will cover is the period of Richard Nixon's Vietnam, the Reform Commission, McGovern's work for at home for domestic programs to alleviate hunger, to provide better jobs and education for Americans, and of course the 1972 campaign. That will be the major set piece. And then a chapter, perhaps two, but no more than that, after 72 is the postscriptive part of the story. He, of course, with a lot of other major classic liberal senators, went down in 1980 in the Reagan landslide.
And yet he ran for the presidency one more time.
Yes, in 1984, he pursued the nomination, and he got tremendous press. That was really an impressive effort on his part. And that was the year, of course, of Walter Mondale's. It was a very creditable candidate, Walter Mondale's campaign against Reagan in 1984. Probably another impossible situation running against Reagan. It's a different time, of course, but it was roughly analogous to trying to unseat Nixon in 1972, when Nixon by 72 had brought home 95% of the troops that were there when he came into office in 1969, although we continued to bomb the heck out of Vietnam, bringing the troop levels from over 500,000 down to about 30 or 40,000 by the summer of 72, was what most Americans were concerned about. And of course, earlier in 72, Nixon had made his historic trip to the People's Republic of China, began the opening of China, which resulted also in the beginnings of detente with the Soviets. Probably it wouldn't have mattered who the Democrats nominated in 72, Muskie, Humphrey, they all would have gone down, I think, that year.
Well, I for one am definitely looking forward to reading it, and I hope that when it comes out, we can have you back on the show.
Great. Well, thank you, Mark, very much. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you very much. On behalf of New Books Network and our listeners, thanks for being on the show, and have a wonderful day.